Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with President Obama's meeting with the new Saudi King Salman, along with a huge delegation of high-level American officials, including the current Secretary of State and two former Secretaries of State, the current National Security Advisor and three former National Security Advisors, as well as Obama's former 2008 presidential rival John McCain and the current head of the CIA. David Hurst, the editor of Middle East Eye, who was formerly the chief foreign leader writer of The Guardian, joins us to discuss the apparent healing of the rift between the two countries and a possible payback for Saudi Arabia for lowering the price of oil to hurt Iran, Russia, and Venezuela that some analysts suggest is being done at the behest of the U.S. Then we'll examine the dark and murky political scandal erupting in Argentina, with the president dissolving the powerful intelligence agency she is accusing of involvement in the murder of the chief prosecutor who had charged her with covering up Iranian involvement in the 1994 Buenos Aires bombing in exchange for Iranian oil. Hayley Cohen joins us from Buenos Aires, Argentina, where she is a correspondent for The Economist covering Argentina and Uruguay, to discuss the shady history of Argentina's intelligence secretariat and its recently fired former J. Edgar Hoover-like head, who wiretapped politicians and journalists, and the sudden flight from the country of the journalist who broke the story of the prosecutor's death, who claims he feared for his life. Then finally, we will assess the likely impact of the $889 million the Koch brothers network is poised to spend in the 2016 elections, which is close to what Obama and Romney each spent in the last presidential election, and well over what John Kerry and George W. Bush combined spent in the 2004 campaigns. Kenneth Vogel, the chief investigative reporter for Politico, who tracks the confluence of money, politics, and influence, joins us to discuss the latest Koch brothers conclave of millionaires and billionaires, at which Republican presidential hopeful Ted Cruz praised the patriotism of the job creators, saying the Kochs have endured vilification from the Democrats with equanimity and grace. And joining us now from London is David Hurst, the editor of Middle East Eye. He was formerly the chief foreign leader writer of The Guardian, former associate foreign editor, European editor, Moscow bureau chief, European correspondent, and Ireland correspondent for The Guardian. And his latest article at the Huffington Post is A Saudi Palace Coup. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Hurst.
Hello.
And President Obama's trip to Saudi Arabia to meet with the new King Salman, cutting short his state visit to India. It's not just President Obama that's making this pilgrimage to Saudi Arabia following a number of heads of state, but his rival in the 2008 campaign, Senator John McCain, two former Secretaries of State, James Baker and Condoleezza Rice, three former National Security Advisors, Brent Scowcroft, Stephen Hadley and Samuel Berger, along with Secretary of State John Kerry, Susan Rice, the current National Security Advisor, and John Brennan, the director of the CIA, and a number of others as well. This is more than paying condolences, surely.
Yeah, it's everyone but the kitchen sink. I mean, they really are making a huge effort for the Saudis. And I think this is a reflection of two main things. It's one, how the relationship really went off the rails with the previous King Abdullah. When 4 years ago there was a series of huge revolution in Egypt, and Abdullah's best mate in the region, Hosni Mubarak, was ousted from power, and Abdullah blamed Obama for that and said that the Americans had simply stood by. The relationship deteriorated further when Obama refused to bomb Assad after the chemical attack in Damascus, and the Saudis were openly scornful of America, and they were calling Obama a poodle. And now what we have is a sort of change of regime. We have a new half-brother who is quite interesting in his own right, except he's probably quite sick. And we have a new bunch of people around who probably are more pragmatic than the previous regime. So there's a lot for America to shoot for in regaining influence in a key player in a very, very turbulent region.
And in your recent Huffington Post article, David Hurst, a Saudi palace coup, you point out that a bigger change, in a sense, was the ousting of the Eminence Gris, the Cardinal Richelieu of Abdullah's royal court, Khalid al-Tuwaisri.
Yes, this was a sort of father and son arrangement, and they had a huge power. They were like the sort of royal gatekeepers, and no audience could be had with the king without their knowledge or without their say-so. And Saudi Arabia is a really quite interesting place. It certainly was very, very interesting under Abdullah, in the sense that Abdullah was the king, but you had these very, very powerful princes who all had ministries behind them, and they had their own entourage. So it was a question of who could gain access to the king. And I had sort of diplomats from the Gulf who were also part of the Gulf Cooperation Council saying the Saudi foreign policy could change from morning to afternoon, depending on who had got access to the king. I think what we're going to see now, I mean, it's no one knows what we're going to see now. Absolutely no one knows how the king and how the new king is. There are hints, but no one actually knows for sure. It's all Kremlinology. It's all guessing. But as an educated guess, I think there's some very interesting people, not new people necessarily. There's an extremely interesting interior minister called Mohammed bin Nayef, who is educated in the U.S. And a pragmatist, and he's a hard security guy. He could make a big difference to the policy, and also the people around King Salman himself.
So, but my understanding is that this Mohammed bin Nayef that you just mentioned, who's the deputy crown prince, and he's clearly in line. If King Salman has Alzheimer's, he's also suffered from a stroke, he's somewhat immobile on one arm, he may not last long, and the youngest brother, right, Merkan, is next in line. He's pretty colourless, isn't he? So is this new?
Not only is he colourless, he's got a Yemeni mother, and that is not good from the point of view of the Saudi lineage.
So is Mohammed bin Nayef then the new Eminence Gris?
Well, he certainly is one of them. He himself hasn't got any daughters, so he doesn't have anything personally to gain or to hand over to a favoured son. And he is also a really quite hard-working counter-terrorism specialist. So, he has very close links with America and the CIA. So, he was in fact attending a counterterrorism conference in London at the time of the king's death. Now, I think all of them have they all share a horror of Islamism in any form, whether it's radical Islam or political Islam. But there may be a more pragmatic element has entered the Saudi frame, and that would be particularly important when it comes to the Saudi support for military dictators like President Sisi of Egypt, and I would imagine that particular person is feeling very nervous right now.
And he didn't show up for the funeral?
He didn't show up for the funeral. He blamed bad weather.
Right. But given the security creds of the deputy crown prince, the second in line, Mohammed bin Nayef, the fact that there are all of these security people from the United States, everybody that was anybody in the national security realm, a current and former, you have to assume that they're having some serious talks. And if there is a new strategy underway in Saudi Arabia following the failed strategies of King Abdullah and Prince Sultan, then you would think that there was there's something cooking.
Well, there's quite a lot to talk about because it's pretty chaotic at the moment. I mean, to the north, you've got the black flags of the Islamic State, and Saudi Arabia is halfway through or just started building a huge security fence at the top, which will take a long time to finish. To the south, you've got Yemen, which is in absolute chaos at the moment after the phoenix-like rise of northern Iranian-backed Shia tribesmen called the Houthis, and al-Qaeda as a resurgent force in the south of Yemen. So there's chaos there as well. You've also got the price of oil. You've got Iran and what could be a breakthrough deal between between Obama and Iran on the nuclear deal. That would have ramifications for Saudi Arabia. And also the Iranian foreign minister turned up at Abdullah's funeral, which is particularly interesting. So the regional rivalries, there's a lot going on. And I think what the United States needs at the moment is a line back into the thinking of a very, very strategic state, because what was happening before was that the Saudis were doing their own thing, they were going their own way, and America, like a sort of worried, anxious parent, was sort of wringing its hands, but really not able to influence them that much. And the Saudis did their own thing, and they did their own sort of foreign adventures, of which Yemen is a classic case.
Well, arguably, the misadventures in Iraq and Syria have blown up in their face, and the extent to which Prince Bandar Sultan did encourage the so-called Islamic State. But on the other hand, recent developments in Yemen, as you point out in your article, a Saudi palace coup at the Huffington Post, David Hurst, that there is some chicanery going on there with the Saudis, their proxy in Yemen, who's been deposed, Abdullah Saleh, has been dealing behind the scenes with the Houthis, who've grabbed power. And some analysts suggest that perhaps Yemen will be divided again into North and South Yemen, and the deal behind the scenes was that the Houthis get the North and the Saudis end up controlling the South, where the oil terminals are, to the Indian Ocean. And if they were able to develop those oil terminals, then they could bypass the Gulf and the Straits of Hormuz, over which Iran has some military leverage if they decide ever to close the Straits of Hormuz.
Well, that's certainly one theory kicking around. There are quite a few. I mean, I think what happened was that whatever was intended by helping the Houthis, and it's a very dangerous tactic because basically the Houthis are trained by Hezbollah and they're armed by Iran. And this is whatever else is going on in Yemen. A ruler in Riyadh has to think of their vulnerable southern border. But I think what happened, trying to put the pieces of the jigsaw together, was that the Houthis advanced too far and too quickly, because the plan was for them to be resisted by ISLA, which is the Islamist Muslim Brotherhood type political organization, which, like everyone else in Yemen, is armed. And for the two enemies to fight it out. It was a sort of classic divide and rule tactic, except that Israel did not take up arms, and the Houthis suddenly found themselves all over Sana'a, the capital. Indeed, they're currently providing the protection for the American embassy, which is an embarrassment, considering they say death to Jews and death to Israel. It's a very fluid situation at the moment. I mean, pessimistically and potentially, you've got two highly armed forces, the Houthis versus al-Qaeda, and that is a desperately bad situation for Saudi to be in. There are now, the resignation of the Yemeni president Hadi still stands, but there are attempts now to try and get talks going for the Houthis to release some of their hostages and for an election to take place. As you and I have both said, the ancient strongman Saleh is still around and putting strings. And his long-term aim is to get his son, Ahmed Ali Abdullah Saleh, in pole position. So we're talking here about a completely chaotic scene of militias, rival militias, and it'll take a while to calm this situation down.
And the Houthis have just handed back Hadi's chief of staff. But when you mentioned the Islamist party, that's been an obsession, has it not, of the previous Saudi foreign policy regime?
Yes.
They just go after the Muslim Brotherhood wherever they are. That's why they were so much in support of Sisi. And are they in any way, is Prince Nayef in any way more nuanced in his approach to the idea of this rival, which, of course, the Saudi, you know, medieval monarchy is opposed to any form of Islam?
Well, that's a very good question. The honest answer is I don't know. It's impossible to say. I mean, I think they took the whole of the Saudi regime, all the family, took a strategic decision that when the Muslim Brotherhood came to power in Egypt, they said this is not going to happen ever again, and it's certainly not going to happen in Egypt. And all of them, whether they were pragmatic or whether they were neocon, basically adopted the same policy of doing everything they could to subvert Morsi in Egypt, but also to fund a sort of counter-revolution, which is still taking place in Libya and Tunis as well. They were in everything. They wanted to stop the Brotherhood wherever they came. Whether they're more nuanced now or not remains to be seen. I had two sources in Egypt tell me separately that they were approached by senior advisors of the then Prince Salman to say, look, can we work something out? Can we stage a reconciliation between the Brotherhood and the Egyptian opposition and Sisi? And they were very, very preliminary talks, but they were given to understand that Prince Salman could, as king, change the Saudi policy. I'm not sure whether things are as clear-cut as that. Certainly, one can say that Prince Nayef is, in terms of radical Islam, a hardliner. But he also realizes that if you crack down on radical Islamists and their families, you just create more of them. So then the position may become more nuanced. If he sees that Sisi is, in fact, creating more terrorism than he's actually killing, in terms of his crackdown on the Sinai and in terms of his crackdown on unarmed protesters. You know, that the killing to this day continues. There were over 20 people killed in the commemoration of the anniversary. Plus, policemen were killed as well. It's not totally unviolent, the protest. But if Nayef sees that this is not the way to go, I think Saudi policy could change. Now, if that happens, I'm not saying it will, but if it happens, Sisi is very vulnerable because Egypt is the economy has been sinking under his reign. It hasn't got any better, and they're totally dependent just for liquid cash on the $20 billion that the Saudis have handed out, and also equal sums of money that the United Arab Emirates have handed out. So they're very vulnerable to a Saudi change of policy. So it'll be very, very interesting to watch. Now, I'm not saying any of this is going to happen, and it could sound like wish fulfillment, but if the Saudis start to recognize the difference between the radical, the jihadis, the radical Islamists, and people who purely want a political way, even though they are Islamists, then I think that would be a positive development, because all of this can be seen from the point of view of however it's expressed, whether it's expressed through Islamism or through secular politics, as a pushback against autocracy throughout the Arab world.
Well, just in closing, David Hurst, what do you make of the lowering of the price, flooding the market with oil to lower the price? There's been some signals from Saudi officials. One said that they're getting rid of marginal producers, which I assumed meant the frackers. Another official said that this could last for some time and that they expect the global demand to decrease, obviously, as people become more conscious of global warming. And maybe the Saudis have figured out that maybe there's only 10 or 20 years left before, you know, the manifestation of global warming is such that maybe oil will be banned. Hard to get your head around now, but still possible. What's your read on what's going on there with oil?
Well, I think there are two sort of broad theories as to why the oil price collapsed. One is a political and a conspiracy theory that this was done with the backing of the White House for a political reason, and that was to suck dry the Russian economy, to punish Putin for his territorial grab in eastern Ukraine and the Crimea, and also to take a bit of wind out of the Iranian sail as well. That's one theory. The second theory is that the price of oil was going to collapse anyway. And that OPEC has always been bad at sharing out the pain and getting other people to cut. And it's always it's less of a cartel and more of an internal a competition. So they're trying to cut out fellow producers and everyone is trying to get more market share. I mean, secretly, recently, Saudi Arabia have just increased their production to 9.8 million barrels a day, which is 300,000 barrels more than the sort of registered output by OPEC. And analysts have said that that is to get market share back from the U.S. Shale drillers. I think the truth is probably some way between those two theories. Certainly, it helps the U.S. In terms of getting some leverage over Putin and possibly getting some leverage over Iran in its current talks, but also that the price was going to drop anyway. It's now, $48 a barrel? That's collapsed from its peak of $147 in 2008. So we are seeing a sort of industry worldwide readjustment, and we are also seeing quite a lot of politics. I mean, the only thing I would say is that if there was a political side to this and if there was a secret deal done between the Saudis and the Americans to put pressure on Russia and Iran at a time when it was sensitive for both economies, then I think Saudi Arabia are in a position of demanding more support from America, payback time, if you'd like, if things get tough for them in the region, because that action has undoubtedly helped the White House interest in those two arenas.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, David Hurst.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking to David Hurst, who's in London. He's the editor of Middle East Eye. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back looking into the dark and murky political scandal erupting in Argentina. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now from Buenos Aires, Argentina, is Hayley Cohen, a correspondent for The Economist covering Argentina and Uruguay. Welcome to Background Briefing, Hayley Cohen.
Thanks, Ian.
And this extraordinary scandal in Argentina involving the president, Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner, and the country's intelligence service, known as the Intelligence Secretariat, by the acronym C, which of course means yes. And just a cursory look into their background since they first started out after having been founded by Argentina's strongman, General Juan Perón, in 1946. Their first task, of course, was to arrange for the post-war transport of Nazi war criminals to Argentina. Not exactly an auspicious beginning. What's your understanding in terms of this story? It doesn't seem to be that in this battle between the president, who's just dissolving the intelligence agency, and the intelligence agency, there doesn't seem to be any good guys here.
I think that that's an accurate reading of what's going on here in Argentina. I don't think that anyone was overly shocked to hear Cristina Kirchner call for the dissolution of the intelligence agency last night in the speech that she gave without much warning late in the evening. People, both from the opposition and from public policy groups, have called for reforms to the intelligence system for a long time. So in that sense, they don't disagree with this move by Cristina. But there's a lot of concern over exactly what form this reorganization process will take.
So was this recently fired head of the intelligence Directorate, Antonio Jaime Stiuso? How do you pronounce that?
Yeah, Stiuso.
He apparently was a very feared figure and a very shadowy figure. There's very little, and I think there are too many photographs of him even.
No, he certainly wasn't very press friendly. He didn't give many interviews, and as you said, he's a figure that looms large in this story, but there's very little that's actually known about him.
And is it fair to characterize this intelligence service as being something like the Stasi in East Germany? I mean, were they that ubiquitous? I understand they, just like J. Edgar Hoover, they kept files on politicians and judges and political figures and journalists, too.
Yes, they certainly had a wide scope in terms of who they gathered intelligence on. I'm not sure I would go quite that far, but they certainly, as I said, had quite a extensive purview.
And were they complicit, as many have charged, in the dirty war? Were they the ones that sort of helped target people that the military subsequently tortured and killed?
Those are the rumors. You know, there's still a lot that's not known. And just as in today's situation with the Nisman scandal, just how much the intelligence agency actually collaborated with Nisman and how much information they provided him to aid him in writing his complaint is still not entirely known.
And just to turn to the scandal and the president's announcement that she was dissolving the intelligence service, of course, this was preceded by the mysterious death of the chief prosecutor, who was about to testify before the Congress when he was found dead. And added to the intrigue is, of course, the sudden disappearance or exodus, I guess, of the journalist who first reported on the suspicious death of the Argentine prosecutor, Damian Pachter. He has fled to Israel, claiming that he's fearing for his life in Argentina. And there's been some scandal surrounding that, has there not, in terms of the government news service releasing some tweets attributed to him that he says he didn't put out, and also that the Argentine Airlines released information about his travel arrangements, which also he claims endangered him. So I don't know quite where to start. Well, let's start with the journalist. What do you understand about him? He says he fled the country fearing for his life.
Yes, Mr. Pachter worked at an English language newspaper in Buenos Aires called the Buenos Aires Herald. I believe he has some Israeli heritage. He was in the Israeli army at some point, but had worked here for a couple of years. He felt, and he wrote an account of this in an Israeli newspaper that was released on Monday, but he felt that his life was in danger in Argentina after he was the first one to break the story that Prosecutor Alberto Nisman had been found dead in his apartment. he claimed that the government alluded to, or government news wire alluded to, this tweet that he never wrote, and he interpreted that as a coded message that he should get out of the country. So he bought a ticket to Uruguay and then to Madrid and finally on to Tel Aviv, and the government proceeded to publish part of this flight itinerary on their website, which caused a large amount of controversy, as you can imagine, and even sparked some opposition lawmakers to question whether the national airline had committed a crime in releasing this private information. What they were trying to prove in releasing the flight information was that Damian Pachter, in fact, was intending to return to Argentina in February, which is an allegation that he denies. I don't know if he bought a round-trip ticket because that was the cheaper thing to do, or in fact, that's not an accurate representation of his flight itinerary. But that's what we know. So I think even if he wasn't stalked by intelligence agents, the way that the government responded to his allegations is completely outsized and inappropriate for a state.
And at a television news conference in Tel Aviv, Damian Pachter did say that he held Israeli citizenship, but he also went on to say, "Argentina has become a dark place led by a corrupt political system. I still haven't figured out everything that has happened to me over the past 48 hours." Is that an accurate description of the mood there? You've got lots of people demonstrating, holding up signs, calling for justice. Apparently, there's a pretty pervasive cynicism in the population about the government, and particularly this current president. And, of course, this scandal is so dark and murky, it's hard not to believe that there's, you know, a great need for clarity, shall we say.
Yes, that's definitely the mood here, and I don't think it was helped at all by Cristina Kirchner's speech last night. I think many people were hoping to be reassured by their leader in this time of great uncertainty, and instead what happened was, Cristina called for the reform of the intelligence system and the replacement of the current Secretary of Intelligence with a new agency that especially the opposition fears would be politicized, which in an election year when there's a political transition imminent is not good news for anyone. And she proceeded in this speech last night also to link Prosecutor Niesman's death with the opposition media. She essentially used it as an excuse to bring up all of her favorite enemies and cast blame on them.
And that would be Clarín, right? The paper that she has a sort of obsession with. But it's hard not to see, you know, a certain amount of sort of raw politics and cynical politics in this. Stusio, the former intelligence head that she fired, he, of course, was originally hired by her husband, the late president, who hired him because of the enormous amount of help that he'd been given by the intelligence service in their wiretapping of political opponents of the Kirchners. And then he he must have served her well up to the point where she found out apparently that Niesman was preparing charges against her, and she was furious that Stusio had not alerted her to that fact, and that's why she fired Stusio, and she was also preparing to fire the chief prosecutor Niesman as well, was she not?
I'm not positive about that. I know that in December, she was certainly not happy with Niesman. And Niesman had also actually been appointed by her husband, Nestor Kirchner, her late husband, I should say. He died in 2010. She was furious with him. I'm not sure that she was trying to replace him as well. But in December, she had replaced Stusio with a former member of her cabinet that was very close to her and that she felt like she could rely on.
But this huge data dump that Niesman did in this 300-page report full of accusations against her, a lot of the data and evidence are wiretaps. And it would seem that given that apparently there was this kind of father and son relationship between the prosecutor and the former head of intelligence, you know, it certainly looks as though they've got the goods on Fernandez, on the president.
Yes, it would look that way. I've talked to some criminal lawyers since the entire 289-page report was released and made public last week. You know, I think that there are a lot of very suspicious things in this document. Not many of the legal references that I talked to were ready to say that, you know, Niesman had complete and undeniable proof that there was a crime committed. And many actually think that that would have been a hard thing to prove, but it certainly doesn't look good for Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner. And, you know, the politics are just as important sometimes as the actual facts.
But apparently in these documents, there are even recordings, I think, of conversations between an Iranian official, Moshe Rabbani, in the city of Qom, the religious capital of Iran and the home of the current regime. He was also the former cultural attaché in Buenos Aires at the time of the bombing of the Jewish Center in 1994 that killed 85 people. They seem to have a fairly strong case. And my understanding is that the former intelligence head was also very close to the CIA and to Mossad. And so how would you characterize this battle between the former intelligence chief and the current president? The main charge is that she was involved in a cover-up with the Iranians in order to make a deal selling Argentine wheat for Iranian oil, and that the agreement was when this joint Argentine-Iranian Truth Commission was set up, that it was set up by the current president basically to whitewash the entire bombing of the Jewish Center.
Yeah, so once again, I would say that in this case, I think sometimes the perceptions of the Argentine people are every bit as important as the actual facts. As you said, there's some incriminating wiretaps that are mentioned in this complaint. The issue is that the wiretaps never actually capture any of the highest level officials in contact with these Iranian contacts. So there is plausible deniability there where, you know, if need be, Cristina Kirchner or Hector Timmerman, the foreign minister, could say, oh, yeah, this person said that I ordered them to make this call or that I was making this call on their behalf. But I didn't really ask them to do that. They were lying. I wouldn't say it's an absolutely airtight case, but it certainly has raised a lot of suspicions in the minds of the Argentine people. And does not bode well for Cristina as she finishes out the last 9 months of her term.
So, but what the complaints now coming from the intelligence service and from their supporters in Argentina are that this purge of the service underway by the president, that she's basically firing all their best anti-terrorist experts and leaving the country vulnerable. You know, those kind of things sound self-serving. Again, you get back to the idea that there are no good guys in this, right? It's hard to have any sympathy for an intelligence service that does the kind of things that J. Edgar Hoover did to discredit the FBI. So I'm not sure who to believe in this, and I guess I'm perhaps not alone. And is that how the Argentine people feel?
Yes, I think that we're in a moment where there's a great amount of uncertainty. And as you said, Argentines are not sure who or what to believe. They're just sure that they doubt a lot of the theories that have already been put on the table and that the president has made it almost impossible to believe that what she says, especially after initially when her preliminary statement after Niesman was found dead, suggested that she believed his death to be a suicide. And then 3 days later, she published another communique on her Facebook page saying that actually rogue intelligence agents were responsible for his murder. And last night tried to claim that she never actually changed her mind and that the first people had just misinterpreted the first statement that she had posted.
Well, I must say her body language in her speech Well, it's kind of bizarre. I mean, this is not somebody that seemed to have a good, strong grasp on things.
It was extremely bizarre. I mean, so she, for those who haven't seen the speech, she addressed the public from a wheelchair in a taped address. Normally, in these types of addresses, which are quite frequent, she addresses the public from behind a desk. And in this case, she chose not to do that, which left the wheelchair in a very conspicuous sight of the camera. She had broken her ankle in December, which is why she was using the wheelchair. But it, for many, it was a very odd, it made for very weird optics, and contributed to the sensation that she was victimizing herself while simultaneously aggressively accusing her favorite enemies, such as Clarine, of somehow playing a part in this scandal.
As if a bunch of journalists were at the heart of this scandal. It's pretty. It seems like a pretty weak read, isn't it?
It certainly has sparked a lot of satire on social media about, you know, people. It's very hot here, and people are waiting for it to rain, and people are blaming Claudine for the heat and the fact that it hasn't started raining to alleviate that yet. It's definitely seen as a weak case.
Well, just in closing, Hayley Cohen, you would think that if this deal was made, the wheat for oil deal that she's accused of making, that the intelligence service and the prosecutor, with the evidence that provided to him by the intelligence service, had claimed that the cover-up of the Iranian bombing of the Jewish center in 1994 was done in order to alleviate the foreign exchange problem or alleviate the cost of foreign oil to save the country about something like $7 billion, and that they did a wheat-for-oil deal with the Iranians. Wouldn't there be a lot of paperwork on that? Wouldn't there be a paper trail?
No, because the deal never actually was completed. And the reasons behind that are fairly murky. But the rumors are that what Christina had promised was that she would somehow lobby for the exculpation of the Iranian suspects in this bombing, and that in return, Iran and Argentina would engage in this grain for oil deal, where Argentina would export grain and import Iranian oil to aid in alleviating its energy deficit. That deal never actually went through, in part because Christina either was never able to get the Iranian suspects exculpated or never even tried to do that. We don't know. And also because the accord with between Argentina and Iran, or the Truth Commission that was introduced in early 2013, was never approved by the Iranian Congress and was later ruled unconstitutional in Argentina. So that's the argument for why you wouldn't actually see money changing hands that proves this allegation a little bit more concretely.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Hayley Cohen.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Hayley Cohen, who is in Buenos Aires. She is the correspondent for The Economist covering Argentina and Uruguay. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the impact of the $889 million the Koch Brothers Network is poised to spend in the 2016 election.
It's the money.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Kenneth Vogel, the chief investigative reporter for Politico, who tracks the confluence of money, politics, and influence. He has covered politics and government at all levels, from small-town cop shops and school boards to state houses, Congress, and the presidential campaign trail, traveling during the 2008 race with the campaigns of Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, Sarah Palin, and Joe Biden. He's the author of Big Money, $2.5 Billion, One Suspicious Vehicle, and A Pimp, On the Trail of the Ultra-Rich Hijacking of American Politics. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kenneth Vogel.
Hey, it's great to be back with you, Ian.
And, Ken, in terms of the ultra-rich hijacking of American politics, the fact that the Koch brothers' network has basically put up a bid of $889 million to essentially buy the 2016 elections, and that, of course, is equal to what both Mitt Romney and Barack Obama spent in the last election, and equal to the combined spending of both George W. Bush and John Kerry in the 2004 election. So this is not chump change.
Yeah, this is a huge and really historic sum, if in fact the Kochs and their donors are able to meet. And there's no reason to believe that they won't be able to meet this spending goal. They have been really methodical about both plotting their spending and raising the money to support their spending in the past. It really underscores the migration of money and political power, the political power that comes with money, away from the political parties and their candidates and their candidates' campaigns to these outside groups that are funded by, in some cases, just a handful of billionaires. And what makes the Koch so influential in this new world is not just their own wealth, which is, of course, incredibly substantial. They're worth $40 billion each, Charles and David Koch are, but rather their ability to convene and rally and mobilize like-minded conservative donors from across the country and across a lot of industries, though there are a lot of sort of old-line, you know, oil, gas, industrialists like the Kochs who are in their network. But they've really built something quite unprecedented, I think, in American history, American political history, that is almost a third political party that operates in some ways in concert with the Republican Party, but in other ways at odds with it. And while Republicans are really cheering this news and this number, there are some who are kind of worried about it because the Kochs sort of do what they want, and they're not necessarily always on the same page with Republicans.
But surely you could make the case, though, couldn't you, Kenneth Vogel, that most, if not all, of this money ends up supporting some kind of Republican? That none of this $889 billion is going to support one Democrat, as far as I know.
Yeah, that's right. But where you see the potential to shape the Republican Party is when it's being spent on advocacy before Congress, issues that are before Congress, where, you know, they may take a line that is different from that of the Republican Party. Now, you're right that they will, in fact, come around when it comes to the election season, and if not support given Republicans, at least oppose Democrats. So they are sort of closer to the party line on that. But there have been any number of issues where they've taken stances that differ from those of Republican Party leaders on issues pending before Congress, including some major ones like the first debt ceiling fight back in 2011. They were on the other side of Boehner and Mitch McConnell opposing an increase in the debt ceiling. Now, when it came to the big debt ceiling fight in 2013 that ended up shutting down the government, they took a little bit more of a nuanced position, but they still weren't exactly in the Republican fold on that either. Where you would really see the potential impact in shaping the party and maybe being at loggerheads with the party would be if they would weigh in Republican primaries, obviously the biggest one being the 2016 Republican presidential primary. They've yet to do that, but we've found, as we've reported this out, really quite a bit of appetite among their donors and among the operatives in the Koch network for engaging in the primary. So if they were to pick a horse there, then you would see the real potential for them to flex their muscles in a way that, again, may be different from that of the sort of mainstream Republican Party.
But the extent to which Senators Ted Cruz, Rand Paul, Marco Rubio, Scott Walker, and other Republicans have made their pilgrimages to Kansas to basically, kneel at the feet of the Koch brothers and ask them for money for their campaigns. If they're not choosing a Republican candidate in the upcoming presidential campaign, of which there is a very, very big field and a deep bench, if you will, if they're not already choosing, the supplicants are certainly putting themselves forward, aren't they?
Yeah, that's right. None of them can stand the potential risk that the Kochs, either officially through their network and some of the groups in their network, or unofficially as individuals, or even just as individual donors whose last names are not spelled K-O-C-H, if any of those folks who have any connection to the Kochs end up picking a candidate in a very public way, it really has a potentially consensus-building effect. And so the prospect that the Kochs may put their finger on the scale of the 2016 Republican presidential primary is enough to have all these folks assiduously courting the support. And frankly, even if they don't weigh in the primary, their level of comfort and level of enthusiasm about whoever is the potential Republican, whoever wins the Republican presidential nomination, I think will go a long way to determine how much of that $889 million gets spent on ads attacking the Democratic nominee or supporting the Republican nominee after the primary.
Well, it seems, Ken Vogel, that the Koch brothers perhaps learned from what happened in their last conclave of millionaires and billionaires that took place in Newport Beach, California, and that was infiltrated by Lauren Windsor, who managed to get quite a lot of information about the agenda and the speakers and even audio that was not particularly intelligible but certainly able to be transcribed. It seems as though at this current, or this just last weekend conclave at Rancho Mirage near Palm Springs, they changed it a little bit, made it a little bit open, not most of the deliberations and seminars, which is how they prefer to refer to these weekends gatherings. But they did have a Sunday night forum, which was live streamed to selected media outlets, and it was moderated by ABC's Jonathan Karl. So are they on a learning curve, do you think, in terms of, because the idea that a bunch of billionaires meet in a back room to decide who becomes president doesn't exactly have the trappings of democratic transparency.
Yeah, I think there's a little bit of that. And then there was a long history, certainly since they became really public figures and since a lot of media attention was focused on their activities on their seminars, of leaks from these seminars, both before the seminars with the agendas and the invitations leaking out to the press, during the seminars with people calling reporters like myself and telling them what happened there, and then after the seminars, leaking out of the results of the seminars. And so I think that they realize from just a pure PR strategy tactics, that like this is a way to get ahead, to be a little more transparent, open the door a little bit, and sort of control the narrative out of it. But I think it's more than that. I think that they really do feel like as they increasingly engage in the political process and spend more and more money in it and become more and more influential in American politics as a whole, and particularly Republican Party politics, that it actually lends credence to their positions and their messages if they are willing to put their names and put their reputations to some extent behind their positions. And so you see that not just with this recent seminar that they just had where, they acknowledged even beforehand, hey, we're having this seminar and it's going to be, somewhere in the California desert and it's going to be on these dates. And yes, they told me, in fact, we are going to have these four likely presidential candidates, Senators Cruz, Rubio, and Rand Paul, and Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker out here. But even before that, in the run-up to the 2014 midterm elections, they started a super PAC, which, of course, does afford them more flexibility in how they spend their money, but also requires, as a trade-off, the disclosure of the donors' names. That was the area that they were most sensitive about and most secretive about, disclosing the names of their donors. Well, here you had them taking a step, and you could argue, well, maybe they were just doing it because they wanted to be able to spend money through a super PAC, But certainly the very well-known side effect of that was that they were going to be required to disclose the names of their donors, and many of the donors did so enthusiastically and were more than happy to talk to me and other reporters about why they were giving to this group. So it is a change, and for a reporter whose job it is to cover this stuff, it's a refreshing one because it sort of helps me do my job, and I think it helps voters and our readers and people who engage in the political process understand a little bit more about where these folks are coming from.
But thanks to the Supreme Court, none of this would be happening. And the Supreme Court, in spite of the fact that in their Citizens United decision, they talked about how there would be disclosure. It hasn't happened. In fact, the reverse has happened, where through these 501c4s, IRS so-called social welfare vehicles, huge amounts of money are pouring in, and they are likely to, a big chunk of this almost $1 billion that the Kochs are putting up will end up being anonymous and unattributed. But what about the scale of things? Does anybody in those billionaire-millionaire conclaves get the simple point that, say, the average American citizen who wants to get involved in politics gives, what, $100, which would probably be the median, and that's probably a lot more than 90% of Americans would want to spend. But those who feel politically motivated, maybe that's a good average figure, $100. If you've got $40 billion, whatever the equivalent of $100 to average person incomes was, if you tried to do the math on how that would translate, well, $40 billion is only half of the money. The two brothers combined have $80 billion. Does anybody, can you do the math, Ken? I mean, in other words, what would the equivalent of a $100 donation to the Koch brothers be?
Yeah, I mean, one of the examples that we sort of threw around in 2012 when Sheldon Adelson was in the midst of that historic, then historic, now sort of like paling in comparison, $100 million spending spree trying to defeat Barack Obama is, $100 million that he spent on the 2012 elections would be the equivalent of like a weekend at one of his casinos, complete with nice meals in the restaurant and maybe a show for like an average family who earned like an average wage. So it's really peanuts to him. And in fact, as I was doing some of the publicity around my book, and I kept on citing Sheldon Adelson, he spent $20 million supporting Newt Gingrich's presidential campaign. Everyone knew Newt Gingrich wasn't going to be president. Can you imagine spending that much money? Why would he spend so much money? And in fact, I had an interviewer turn around on me and say, well, I mean, Sheldon Adelson was worth $30 billion at the time. The question shouldn't be why did he spend so much money supporting his favorite candidate, but rather why did he spend so little if he had so much at his disposal? And I think now we are getting around to answering that question in 2016. We'll get around to answering the question that was posed in 2012 about why these folks sort of seem to be holding back as to why. I don't know. It was this sort of dawn of this new big money era, and I think that the numbers that we're going to see in 2016 are really going to dwarf those that we saw in 2012 as far as big money being spent in politics.
Well, Ken Vogel, I thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, it was my pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Kenneth Vogel, who's the chief investigative reporter for Politico, who tracks the confluence of money, politics, and influence. He's the author of Big Money, $2.5 billion, One Suspicious Vehicle, and A Pimp, on the trail of the ultra-rich hijacking of American politics. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcast at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.